ragged were her troops. She got hurt pretty bad. She'll make it, but she don't look so good. I need you all to find him. He goes by B.B. He may be in 407, inside that vacant apartment, or at his cousin's. I want to see him before you do anything to him. I figured out that the man who had beat up Tanisha was hiding in the building. What if he starts to run or gets crazy? One of the men asked. Can we get him then? Yeah, I suppose. But don't hurt him too bad before I talk to the fool. And don't let him get away. Sudhir, could you call J.T.? I nodded and followed C-Note and the others as they made for the stairwell. I recognized most of them as squatters who helped C-Note fix cars in the warmer months. As soon as we were out of Ms. Bailey's earshot, I told C-Note I wanted to come with him. Call J.T., he said, shaking his head. Don't mess around with this. Do what Ms. Bailey says, boy. C-Note had called me boy only a few times, the last one when a friend of his was caught in a knife fight and C-Note instructed me to watch from inside a car where I couldn't get hurt. I will, I insisted, but I want to go. C-Note realized I wouldn't take no for an answer. Just stay near me, he said. But if shit gets crazy and I tell you to leave, you go, right? You hear me? Eight of us made our way down the stairwell, our breath leaving trails of hot steam in the frigid air. There were a lot of questions I wanted to ask. Who was B.B., and what was his relationship with Tanisha? Did C-Note and the other men know him, but we were moving too fast, and C-Note was preoccupied, his eyes ablaze. We stopped just above the fourth-floor stairwell, since it was thought that B.B. had taken refuge in number 407. "Charlie, you and Blue go ahead," C-Note said. "Shorty, you and them go to the other stairwell in case he runs past. Sudhir and me will stay in the back. Charlie, I'm right behind you, so if he got a knife, just let him go. I'll get him." It struck me that I might not be as far out of the way as I'd planned. All of the men hurried to their positions. I could see the door to number 407 from where I stood in the stairwell with C-Note. Charlie and Blue approached it. Like C-Note, they wore second-hand clothes and ill-fitting shoes. Charlie had a crowbar in his hand. Blue's fist was clenched, but I couldn't see what he was holding. Charlie knocked. The thin wooden door gave a hollow sound. All the other apartments on the floor had thick steel doors, but the CHA used wooden doors to designate which apartments were vacant.
"Yo, nigger," Charlie called out. "Hey, B.B., Tanisha says she wants to talk with you. Come on out. She says she's cool with everything."
He looked back at us. C-Note waved his hands, signaling him to shout again.
"Yo, B.B., Tanisha says she just wants to talk, nigger. I'll take you up there."
Why would B.B. need an escort to go back upstairs, I thought, and why on earth would he believe any of this? Just then a voice rang out from the stairwell above us.
"He's on 11, and he's coming down the stairs. Get him. He's coming down."
C-Note instinctively pinned me against the gallery, letting Charlie and Blue go past. They stopped just inside the stairwell. C-Note and I crouched down a few feet behind them. The intense cold made me shiver. Charlie pressed his hand toward the floor a few times, motioning us to stand still. I had never heard the building so quiet. Apart from the wind and some cars in the distance, the only sound I could make out was a mouse or rat scratching around in the incinerator room. Then, from above, I heard some distant footsteps turning into a rumble. Someone was running down the stairs, breathing heavily. I found myself grabbing onto the back of C-Note's jacket. Charlie and Blue were crouched just in front of us. I made out what was in Blue's hand, brass knuckles. Just as the footsteps reached the fourth floor, Charlie jumped up and swung the crowbar waist high. He struck B.B. full on, bowling him over.
"Yeah, nigger!"
Blue shouted, then jumped up and started pounding B.B. in the side. His head hit the wall of the stairwell and snapped back.
"Leave that bitch alone, you hear me?" Blue shouted, punching him repeatedly in the gut. "You better leave her alone, nigger!"
B.B. was tall and strong, and he threw Charlie off him. He stood up and began shouting, but Blue tackled him, smashing B.B. into the wall. The two of them started tumbling down the stairs. Charlie grabbed B.B.'s leg, so he too fell down the stairwell.
"Grab his other leg!"
Charlie yelled in our direction. C-Note jumped down the stairs and made a grab. Blue, meanwhile, was struggling to get out from under B.B., who had Blue's head in a chokehold. I could see that Blue was struggling to breathe. He looked like he might pass out, or worse.
I felt as if I had to do something. Running over to them, I kicked BB in the stomach, which made him relax his grip on Blue. The other men smothered him, and I could hear his muffled words, "Okay, okay, all right, enough." Blue, the strongest of them, bent BB's arms behind his back, bringing him to his knees. I don't know whether it was the cold air, the adrenaline, or the swift kick I'd delivered, but I was badly out of breath. I leaned against the wall near the incinerator room.
"Charlie, run back up the stairs and make sure he didn't drop nothing," C-Note said. "We'll meet you at the office."
The rest of us walked BB downstairs to Ms. Bailey's office. She wasn't in, so C-Note sent another squatter to fetch her. We all stood outside the office, silent. No one seemed to worry that BB would run away. He sat down on the floor with his head pitched back, resting against the wall. This was my first opportunity to get a good look at him. He was young, his face light-skinned and boyish, but with a menacing air. And he appeared to be aging fast. His nostrils were black, his eyes hollow and glazed, telltale signs of crack use. He wore a brown sweatshirt over a stained white tank top, with loose jeans and unlaced sneakers dirtied by the winter slush. I saw a gang tattoo on his neck, the crescent and star pattern of the Black Pea Stone Nation. The stones had been largely dismantled in the 1980s by the feds, with some remaining factions now aligned with the Black Kings. Why, I wondered, was Tanisha hanging around with this guy? C-Note had caught his breath by now.
"You really fucked up this time, BB."
BB said nothing. He wiped the sweat from his face. I heard Ms. Bailey coming. I'd never seen her move so fast before. She was practically galloping, trailed by Katrina and a few older women in blue tenant patrol jackets. Ms. Bailey hurried past without looking at me. Katrina, however, gave me one of her signature looks that I now recognized as meaning this. "Ms. Bailey's got the situation under control, and all will soon be right with the world." Ms. Bailey unlocked her office door and went inside. Blue and Charlie, who'd returned from upstairs, picked up BB and brought him into the office. BB seemed cooperative. The three of them entered the back room in Ms. Bailey's office, and then someone shut the front door. I stayed outside, along with the other squatters and the tenant patrol women. C-Note, his work done, took off. Then Katrina poked her head out the door and waved me inside. "Get in here," she mouthed silently. I did, and she pointed me to a chair. It was hard to make out the full conversation behind Ms. Bailey's closed door, but once in a while her voice was loud enough for me to hear.
"You got some nerve, young man. Beat her like that. Where do you live, huh? Where do you live? She's a good girl. She owe you money? She wouldn't fuck you? Why did you do that? Say something."
Then came the beating. Charlie, or Blue, or maybe both of them, started hitting BB. I also heard Ms. Bailey cry out in a muffled tone. Maybe Ms. Bailey is hitting him as well, I thought. I heard chairs scuffing the floor. Then, for the first time, I heard BB's voice.
"Oh, shit! Get off me! Fuck that! She deserved it!"
Ms. Bailey started to yell louder.
"Deserved it! You'll get worse if you come around here! Don't ever touch her again! You hear me? You hear me? Don't ever come in this building again!"
Ms. Bailey threw open the door. Blue dragged BB out. His face was badly worked over. He was drooling and mumbling something unintelligible. Blue hustled him past Katrina and me and threw him to the floor on the gallery. Two other men grabbed him and led him toward the stairwell. Ms. Bailey followed them, with the members of the tenant patrol right behind. I started to get up, but Katrina stopped me.
"Sudhir? No, let them go. They're just taking him to the car, and they'll leave him on State Street. Come up with me and see how Tanisha's doing."
Tanisha's aunt answered our knock. She and Tanisha's mother told us that Tanisha was at the hospital. She had some bad bruises, but it seemed as if she'd be okay.
"I don't know what she's going to look like, though," said the aunt. "He beat her pretty good."
Tanisha's mother promised to call Ms. Bailey later that night. We went back downstairs to Ms. Bailey's office. She hadn't returned yet. She was apparently visiting Tanisha at the hospital. So Katrina told me what she knew.
Bibi had been managing Tanisha's modeling career, booking her at lingerie shows and dances. For this, he received a 25% cut, and, according to Katrina, he made Tanisha sleep with him. When Bibi heard that Tanisha was going to sign up with a legitimate modeling agency, he got mad and started beating her. Today wasn't the first time this had happened. In fact, Ms. Bailey had repeatedly warned Bibi to stop, but he kept harassing Tanisha, even stealing money from her apartment. It was only because Ms. Bailey felt there was no other recourse, Katrina explained, that today she had rounded up C-Note and the others to form a sort of militia. In the projects, this was a long-standing practice. Militias were regularly put together to track down stolen property, mete out punishment, or simply obtain an apology for a victim. In a neighborhood like this one, with poor police response and no shelter for abused women, the militias sometimes represented the best defense. "It's hard when you can't get nobody to come around," Katrina said solemnly. She was sitting in Miss Bailey's chair, a soda in hand and her voice assured, seeming for all the world like the heiress to Miss Bailey's throne. "No police, nobody from the hospital. We can't live like this. That's why Miss Bailey is so important, and especially for women. She makes sure we're safe." "I suppose," I said, "but it's a horrible way to live, and wouldn't you rather have the police come around?" "I'd rather not live in the projects," Katrina shot back. "But women are always getting beat on, getting sent to the hospital. I mean, you have to take care of yourself. Miss Bailey makes these men take care of us. I don't see what's wrong with that. Unless you live here, you can't judge us, Sudhir." For some reason, I couldn't restrain the judgmental voice of my middle-class self. "You all didn't call the police, did you?" I blurted out. For the first time since I knew Katrina, she couldn't look me in the eye. "No, we didn't." "Why?" She took a deep breath and raised her head. "Because we're scared of them." "You're scared? Women are scared. Everyone is scared." I asked, "Who exactly is scared? I hear this all the time."
"Everybody. But for women it's different. You wouldn't understand." She paused. "At least we have C-Note and the rest of them when things go crazy."
It was clear that Katrina didn't want to talk further. I decided to ask Miss Bailey about this when things calmed down. I'd seen some police around the neighborhood, and I'd seen them work with Autry at the Boys and Girls Club. But since most tenants were so distrustful of the cops, I kept my interactions with them to a minimum, since I didn't want to be thought of as being with the cops. Still, I had a hard time accepting the idea that tenants wouldn't call the police for something as serious as an assault. I also found it tough to believe that the police wouldn't show up, or, for that matter, that an ambulance wouldn't respond either. But as Katrina sat now, in total silence, staring at me expressionlessly, I realized I might well be wrong. I told her that I'd better get back to my apartment. She didn't acknowledge me. I wanted to do something to help her. "Would you like to get something to eat?" I asked meekly. She shook her head. "Do you want to write me another essay?" I asked. "Do you want to write about what just happened?" Katrina liked to write essays, which I read so that we could discuss them. This was a good way for her to talk through her aspirations as well as the shadows of her past, intense poverty and a bad family situation that I was just starting to learn about. She shrugged. I couldn't tell if that meant yes or no. "Well, I'm happy to read it if you do write something, whenever." "Thanks," she said. The barest hint of a smile came to her face, and she pushed her thick black-framed glasses up on her nose. She started sniffling and reaching for a tissue. She looked no more than 12 years old. "I'll see you around," she said. "I'm sure things will be okay." With Katrina having gone quiet and Miss Bailey at the hospital and C-Note and the other squatters nowhere to be seen, there wasn't anyone left for me to talk with. I thought about visiting J.T., but every time I asked him anything about Miss Bailey, he'd shut me down. "You want to know what she's like? You hang out with her," he said. "I ain't telling you shit." J.T. didn't care much for Miss Bailey's authority, as it occasionally challenged his own. It was well within her power, for instance, to close off the lobby to his sales crew. J.T. wanted me to experience Miss Bailey for myself, to see what he had to deal with. I took the bus back to my apartment, but decided to stop first at Jimmy's, a local bar where a lot of U of C professors and students hung out.
No one knew me there, and I could sit quietly and process what had just happened in my fieldwork. Sometimes I would go there to write up my notes, but more often I just sat and stared blankly into my glass. With increasing frequency, Jimmy's was a ritual stop on my way home. At Jimmy's, as at the best bars, no one cared what troubles I brought to the table. Most of the people were sitting alone, like me, and I figured they were dealing with their own problems. Jimmy's gave me a place to take off one hat, the field worker, and put on the other, the student. I needed this break because I was starting to feel schizophrenic, as if I were one person in the projects. Sometimes I caught myself even talking in a different way, and another back in Hyde Park. Increasingly, I found I was angry at the entire field of social science, which meant, to some degree, that I was angry at myself. I resented the fact that the standard tools of sociologists seemed powerless to prevent the hardships I was seeing. The abstract social policies that my colleagues were developing to house, educate, and employ the poor seemed woefully out of touch. On the other hand, life in the projects was starting to seem too wild, too hard, and too chaotic for the staid prescriptions that social scientists could muster. It struck me as only partially helpful to convince youth to stay in school. What was the value of giving kids low-paying menial jobs when they could probably be making more money on the streets? In the poverty seminars that Bill Wilson sponsored, where some of the best academic minds congregated to discuss the latest research, I acted as if I had a unique insight into poverty by virtue of my proximity to families. I prefaced my questions by blurting out a self-serving objection. No one here seems to have spent much time with the poor, but if you did, you would see that, or if you actually watched poor people instead of just reading census tables, you would understand that. I felt as though the other scholars were living in a bubble, but my arrogant tone did little to help anyone hear what I was trying to say. I worried that my behavior might embarrass Wilson, but I was too bitter to take a moderate stance. I wouldn't say that I was disillusioned with the academic life per se. I still attended classes, worked with professors and met my deadlines, earned pretty good grades, and even received a few prestigious fellowships. I still saw myself on the road to being a professor like Wilson, but day by day, it was getting harder to reconcile my life at the U of C with my life in the projects. Rather than sharing my frustration with my girlfriend, my roommates, and my friends, most of whom were actually quite supportive and curious about my research, I just kept my experiences to myself. How could I explain the vigilante justice that C-Note and the others had just delivered? How could I explain my own role in the beating? I didn't understand it myself, and I feared that I'd open myself up to my friend's advice. You need to call the police if they don't. You're getting too involved. You've gone too far. When I did try talking about my fieldwork, I felt awkward. In fact, I sometimes came off as defending the gangs and their violent practices, or as romanticizing the conditions in the projects. So to stay sane, I'd usually just tell people about Autry's work at the Boys and Girls Club, or, if pushed, a few stories about life in the gang. I was growing quieter and more solitary. My fellow graduate students and even some faculty members thought of me as unapproachable. Rumors circulated that I was too ambitious, too aloof, but I figured I'd just have to live with them. A small part of me hoped that life would get back to normal once my field work was over, but the end didn't seem very near, so I just kept to myself. I was eager to know more about the incident with B.B. Why had Miss Bailey sicked the squatters on him instead of leaving it to the police? Had the police been called? Katrina said they hadn't, but I wanted to be sure. And if so, why didn't they respond? What were the consequences for Miss Bailey of taking such matters into her own hands? I waited until check day to go see Miss Bailey. That's when welfare checks were distributed, which meant that most tenants were out buying food and clothing and household items, and not, therefore, coming to Miss Bailey with demands. On the way up to her office, I stopped in to see JT. He was lying on the sofa watching TV. Miss May gave me a big hug and told me to sit down for lunch. She had cooked some of my favorites, okra, greens, mac and cheese, and so I gladly obliged. JT quipped that I was eating his share of the food. "You're becoming the little brother I never wanted," he said. I told him about Miss Bailey and the BB incident. "Oh, man," he said with a laugh. "That's why she's so upset."
She keeps asking if I've seen you. Why's she upset at me? Because you beat the shit out of that man, the one who beat Tanisha. I told you to be careful with Miss Bailey, not to do things for her. First of all, I didn't do anything. Blue was choking, so I kicked the guy to help him. That's not really why she's upset. JT sat up. She thinks that you were spying for us. Remember when I said that she doesn't use us as much anymore? We could have taken care of that man who did that, but she didn't ask us. She asked those fools, C-Note and those crackheads. I knew that JT had tried to persuade Ms. Bailey to call him when a woman in the building got beat up, but I also knew from Katrina that Ms. Bailey wouldn't call JT because his gang members were known to physically and sexually abuse women. By now, JT was in lecture mode. That's why I told you not to do things with her, because I can't be there to protect you. She already knows that you're with me, so she doesn't trust you. According to this theory, Ms. Bailey must have thought I was spying for the gang, keeping track of how often she used non-gang affiliates for enforcing justice in the building. I was taken aback when JT said that I was with him. I hadn't thought my relationship with JT would affect my work with Ms. Bailey, and I certainly wouldn't have predicted she would see me as a spy. His casual aside left me unsure of how to talk with different people in the projects. Once again, I was being asked to pick sides. Was it possible, I wondered, to be in the projects for any length of time and remain neutral, an outsider, an objective observer? JT urged me to go see Ms. Bailey immediately. You might as well deal with this shit, he said. It's not going away. He changed the channel. As I headed for Ms. Bailey's office, I thought that I should probably just confess the truth. I hadn't asked her permission to join C-Note, and I had participated, however minimally, in the beating of BB. Katrina was leaving as I entered. She said nothing, just shook her head as if in disapproval. I stepped into Ms. Bailey's office. Ms. Bailey, I have to apologize. I told her about my involvement with BB. She stared at me for a while. I fidgeted. That's not really what bothers me, Sue dear, she finally said. What bothers me is that you are seeing things and you may not be ready for it. I'm not sure I understand. See, if you were in a war and you were a reporter, you could just say what's going on. No one would be mad at you. But this ain't a war. I try to tell you that all the time. It's every day. Every day something happens like what happened to Nisha, and you're getting yourself in the middle. People are saying, Sudhir's tough. He beat up that man almost by himself. He'll do things for us. You understand why that's a problem? I'm not sure. You think they'll hire me to beat up people? They might not, but they will start talking about you. Sometimes they'll give you credit, and sometimes they'll blame you. Understand? I didn't answer. And when you say, no, I can't help you with that, they'll say, but you helped Nisha, so why won't you help me? Then they'll say, Sudhir don't care about us, or Sudhir is Nisha's manager. Then they'll say, Sudhir is working for Ms. Bailey, and he don't do nothing unless he gets paid. Get it? I think I get it. I sat silently and stared into my hands. When do you think I should see these things? Well, why do you want to see what we do? I mean, why don't you hang around the police? You should figure out why they don't come. Miss Bailey, I wanted to ask you about that. Did you really call the police or the ambulance? Sudhir, the hardest thing for middle-class white folk to understand is why those people don't come when we call. Miss Bailey didn't think I was actually white, but she always tried to show me how my middle-class background got in the way of understanding life in the projects. They just don't come around all the time, and so we have to find ways to deal with it. I'm not sure how much better I can explain it to you. Why don't you watch out for the next few months, see how much they come around? What about Officer Reggie? Yes, he's a friend, but can I tell you how he can be helpful? Not by coming and putting BB in jail, because he'll be out in the morning, but Officer Reggie can visit BB after we're through with him, maybe put the fear in him. Put the fear in him, I don't understand. He could visit BB and tell him that we won't be so nice the next time he does that to Nisha. If BB knows that the cop don't care if we kick his ass, that may make him think twice. That is what we need Officer Reggie for. Miss Bailey, I have to tell you that I just don't get it.
I've been watching you for a while, and it just seems to me that you shouldn't have to be doing everything you're doing. If you got the help you needed, you wouldn't have to act like this. Sue, dear, what's the first thing I told you when you asked about my job? I smiled as I thought of something she told me months earlier. As long as I'm helping people, something ain't right about this community. When they don't need me no more, that's when I know they're okay. But she'd been helping for 3 decades and didn't see any end in sight. One day in the middle of February, the Wilson family lost their front door. The Wilsons lived on the 12th floor, just down the hall from Ms. Bailey. Their door simply fell off its hinges, leaving the family exposed to the brutal cold of a Chicago winter. Even with a front door, the Robert Taylor homes weren't very comfortable in the winter. Because the galleries are outdoors, you can practically get blown over by the lake wind as you walk from the elevator to your apartment. Inside, the winter wind inevitably finds its way through the seams in the doorframe. Chris Wilson worked for the city and moved in and out of Robert Taylor, living off the lease with his wife, Mari, and her 6 children. Chris and Mari were, unsurprisingly, pretty anxious when they lost their door. It wasn't just the cold. They were worried about being robbed. It was common knowledge that drug addicts would pounce on any opportunity to steal a TV or anything else of value. The Wilsons tried calling the CHA but got no response. They put a makeshift door of wooden planks and plastic sheeting, but it didn't keep out the cold. Neighbors who said they'd keep an eye on the apartment didn't show up reliably. So after a few days, the Wilsons called Ms. Bailey. Ms. Bailey leaped into action. She asked JT to station a few of his gang members in the 12th floor stairwells to keep out potential burglars. As a preventive measure, JT also shut down a nearby vacant apartment that was being used as a crack den. Then Ms. Bailey contacted 2 people she knew at the CHA. The first was a man who obtained a voucher so the Wilsons could stay at an inexpensive motel until their door was fixed. The second person was able to speed up the requisition process for obtaining a new door. It arrived 2 days after Ms. Bailey placed her first call. The door didn't come cheap for the Wilsons. They had to pay Ms. Bailey $several hundred, which covered the fees that she paid to her CHA friends, as well as an electrician's bill, since some of the wiring in the Wilsons' apartment went bad because of the cold. Ms. Bailey presumably pocketed the rest of the money. Mari Wilson was, on balance, unperturbed. "Last summer we didn't have running water for a month," she told me, "so 1 week without a door was nothing." Having watched Ms. Bailey help women like Tanisha and families like the Wilsons, I was left with deeply mixed feelings about her methodology, often ingenious and just as often morally questionable. With such scarce resources available, I understood why she believed that the ends justified the means. But collaborating with gangs, bribing officials for services, and redistributing drug money did little to help the typical family in her building. Ms. Bailey had told me that she would much rather play by the rules if only the rules worked. But in the end, I concluded that what really drove Ms. Bailey was a thirst for power. She liked the fact that she could get things done and get paid for it, and she wasn't about to give that up, even if it meant that sometimes her families might get short shrift. Many families, meanwhile, were too scared to challenge her and invite the consequences of her wrath. I was left discouraged by the sort of power bestowed upon building presidents like Ms. Bailey. People in this community shouldn't have to wait more than a week to get a new front door. People in this community shouldn't have to wonder if the ambulance or police would bother responding. People in this community shouldn't have to pay a go-between like Ms. Bailey to get services that most Americans barely bother to think about. No one in the suburb where I grew up would tolerate such inconvenience and neglect. But life in the projects wasn't like my life in the suburbs. Not only was it harder, but it was utterly unpredictable, which necessitated a different set of rules for getting by, and living in a building with a powerful tenant leader, as hard as that life could be, was slightly less hard. It may have cost a little more to get what you needed, but at least you had a chance. Chapter 6. The Hustler and the Hustled. 4 years deep into my research, it came to my attention that I might get into a lot of trouble if I kept doing what I'd been doing. During a casual conversation with a couple of my professors, in which I apprised them of how JT's gang went about planning a drive-by shooting, they often sent a young woman to surreptitiously cozy up to the rival gang and learn enough information to prepare a surprise attack. My professors duly apprised me that I needed to consult a lawyer. Apparently the research I was doing lay a bit out of bounds of the typical academic research. Bill Wilson told me to stop visiting the projects until I got some legal advice. I tried to convince Wilson to let me at least hang out around the Boys and Girls Club, but he shot me a look indicating that his position was not negotiable. I did see a lawyer, and I learned a few important things. First, if I became aware of a plan to physically harm somebody, I was obliged to tell the police, meaning I could no longer watch the gang plan a drive-by shooting, although I could speak with them about drive-bys in the abstract. Second, there was no such thing as researcher-client confidentiality, akin to the privilege conferred upon lawyers, doctors, or priests. This meant that if I were ever subpoenaed to testify against the gang, I would be legally obligated to participate. If I withheld information, I could be cited for contempt. While some states offer so-called shield laws that allow journalists to protect their confidential sources, no such protection exists for academic researchers. It wasn't as if I had any intention of joining the gang in an actual drive-by shooting, nor would they ever invite me. But since I could get into trouble for just driving around with them while they talked about shooting somebody, I had to rethink my approach. I would especially have to be clearer with JT. We had spoken several times about my involvement, when I was gang leader for a day, for instance. He knew my limits, and I understood his. But now I would need to tell him, and perhaps a few others, about the fact that I was legally obligated to share my notes if I was ever subpoenaed. This legal advice was ultimately helpful, in that it led me to seriously take stock of my research. It was getting to be time for me to start thinking about the next stage, writing up my notes into a dissertation. I had become so involved in the daily drama of tagging along with Ms. Bailey and JT that I'd nearly abandoned my study of the broader underground economy my professors wanted to be the backbone of my research. So I returned to Robert Taylor armed with two objectives: let people know about my legal issues and glean more details of the tenants' illegal economic activities. I figured that most people would balk at revealing the economics of hustling. But when I presented the idea to JT, Ms. Bailey, and several others, nearly everyone agreed to cooperate. Most of the hustlers liked being taken seriously as business people, and, it should be said, they were eager to know if they earned more than their competitors. I emphasized that I wouldn't be able to share the details of anyone else's business, but most people just shrugged off my caveat as a technicality that could be gotten around. So with the blessing of JT and Ms. Bailey, I began devoting my time to interviewing the local hustlers, candy sellers, pimps and prostitutes, tailors, psychics, squeegee men. I also told JT and Ms. Bailey about my second problem, my legal obligation to share notes with the police.
"You mean you didn't know this all along?" Ms. Bailey said.
"Even I knew that you have to tell the police what you're doing, unless you give them information on the sly."
"Oh, no," I protested. "I'm not going to be an informant.
Sweetheart, we're all informants around here. Nothing to be ashamed of. Just make sure that you get what you need," I always say, "and don't let them beat you up. I'm not sharing my data with them. That's what I mean."
"You mean you'll go to prison?"
"Well, not exactly. I just mean I won't share my data with them."
"Do you know what being in contempt means?"
When I didn't reply, Ms. Bailey shook her head in disgust. I had seen this look before. She was wondering how I had qualified for higher education given my lack of street smarts.
"Any nigger around here can tell you that you got two choices," she said. "Tell them what they want, or sit in Cook County Jail."
I was silent, trying to think of a third option.
"I'll ask you again," she said. "Will you give up your information, or will you agree to go to jail?"
"You need to know that? That's important to you?"
"Sudhir, let me explain something to you. You think we were born yesterday around here. Haven't we had this conversation 100 times? You think we don't know what you do? You think we don't know that you keep all your notebooks in Ms. May's apartment?"
I shuddered.
Miss May had made me feel so comfortable in her apartment that I had never entertained the possibility that someone like Miss Bailey would think about and perhaps even page through my notebooks. "So why let me hang out?" I asked. "Why do you want to hang out?" "I suppose I'm learning. That's what I do, study the poor." "Okay, well, you want to act like a saint, then you go ahead," Miss Bailey said, laughing. "Of course you're learning, but you are also hustling, and we're all hustlers. So when we see another one of us, we gravitate toward them, because we need other hustlers to survive."
"You mean that people think I can do something for them if they talk to me?"
"They know you can do something for them," she yelped, leaning across the table and practically spitting out her words. "And they know you will, because you need to get your information. You're a hustler. I can see it. You'll do anything to get what you want. Just don't be ashamed of it." I tried to turn the conversation back to the narrow legal issue, but Miss Bailey kept on lecturing me. "I'll be honest with you," she said, sitting back in her chair. "If you do tell the police, everyone here will find you and beat the shit out of you. So that's why we know you won't tell nobody." She smiled as if she'd won the battle. "So who should I be worried about, I wondered? The police or Miss Bailey and the tenants?" When I told J.T. about my legal concerns, he looked at me with some surprise.
"I could have told you that," he said. "Listen, I'm never going to tell you anything that's going to land me in jail or get me killed, so don't bother me what you write down, because I can take care of myself. But that's really not what you should be worried about." I waited. "What you should be asking yourself is this. Am I going to be on the side of the black folks or the cops? Once you decide, you'll do whatever it takes. You understand?"
I didn't.
"Let me try again. Either you're with us, you feel like you're in this with us and you respect that, or you're just here to look around. So far, these niggers can tell that you've been with us. You come back every day. Just don't change, and nothing will go wrong, at least not around here." JT's advice seemed vague and a bit too philosophical. Miss Bailey's warning that I would get beat up if I betrayed confidences made more sense, but maybe JT was saying the same thing in his own way. I decided to focus my study of the underground economy on the three high-rise buildings that formed the core of JT's territory. I already knew quite a bit that squatters fixed cars in the alleys, people sold meals out of their homes, and prostitutes took clients to vacant apartments. But I had never asked people how much money they made, what kind of expenses they incurred, and so on. JT was far more enthusiastic about my project than I'd imagined he would be, although I couldn't figure out why.
"I have a great idea," he told me one day. "I think you should talk to all the pimps. Then you can go to all the whores. Then I'll let you talk to all the people stealing cars. Oh, yeah, and you also have folks selling stolen stuff. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people you can talk to about selling shoes or shirts. And I'll make sure they cooperate with you. Don't worry. They won't say no."
"Well, we don't want to force anyone to talk to me," I said, even though I was excited about meeting all these people. "I can't make anyone talk to me."
"I know," JT said, breaking into a smile, "but I can." I laughed. "No, you can't do that. That's what I'm saying. That wouldn't be good for my research."
"Fine, fine," he said. "I'll do it, but I won't tell you." JT arranged for me to start interviewing the pimps. He explained that he taxed all the pimps working in or around his buildings. Some paid a flat fee, others paid a percentage of their take, and all paid in kind by providing women to JT's members at no cost. The pimps had to pay extra, of course, if they used a vacant apartment as a brothel. They even paid a fee to use the stairwells or a parking lot. As I began interviewing the pimps, I also befriended some of the freelance prostitutes like Clarice, who lived and worked in the building.
"Oh, my ladies will love the attention," Clarice said when I asked for help in talking to these women. Within 2 weeks, I had interviewed more than 20 of them.
Between these conversations and my interviews with the pimps, some distinctions began to emerge. The prostitutes, who were managed by pimps, these women were known as affiliates, had some clear advantages over the independents who worked for themselves.
The typical affiliate was beaten up far less frequently, about once a year, as against roughly 4 times a year for the independents. The affiliates also earned about $20 per week more than the independents, even though their pimps took a 33% cut. $20 wasn't a small sum, considering that the average Robert Taylor prostitute earned only about $100 per week. And I never heard of an affiliate being killed in the line of work, whereas in one recent 2-year stretch, 3 independents were killed. But the 2 types of prostitutes had much in common. Both groups had high rates of heroin and crack use, and they were bound to the projects, where the demand for sex came mostly from low-income customers. At the truck stops on the other side of the Dan Ryan Expressway, barely a mile away from Robert Taylor, but a different ecosystem entirely, a different set of pimps catered to a clientele of white truckers, who paid more than the typical black customer in a housing project. Around Robert Taylor, a prostitute usually earned $10 to $20 for oral sex, sometimes as little as $25 for intercourse, and at least $50 for anal sex. But if she was in need of drugs, she would drop her price significantly or accept a few bags of drugs in lieu of any cash. Once my prostitute research was underway, I asked Ms. Bailey if she would help me meet female hustlers who sold something other than sex. I had casual knowledge of any number of off-the-books businesses, women who sold food out of their apartments or catered parties, women who made clothing, offered marital counseling or babysitting, women who read horoscopes, styled hair, prepared taxes, drove gypsy cabs, and sold anything from candy to used appliances to stolen goods. But since most of these activities were conducted out of public view, I needed Ms. Bailey to open some doors. She was cautious. For the first week, she selectively introduced me to a few women, but refused to let me meet others. I'd suggest a name, and she'd mull it over. "Well," she'd say, "let me think about whether I want you to meet with her." Or just as often, "No, she's not good, but I got someone else for you." Once, after Ms. Bailey introduced me to a psychic, I asked if many other psychics worked in the building. "Maybe, maybe," she said, then changed the subject and left the room. I eventually figured out why she was reluctant to let me explore the underground economy. As it turned out, tenant leaders like Ms. Bailey always got their cut from such activities. If you sold food out of your kitchen or took in other people's children to babysit, you'd better give Ms. Bailey a few dollars, or you might find a CHA manager knocking on your door. If you occasionally cut hair in your apartment, it was probably a good idea to give Ms. Bailey a free styling once in a while. In these parts, Ms. Bailey was like the local IRS, and probably a whole lot more successful at collecting her due. So the people she let me talk to were the ones she probably trusted most not to speak out of line. But I didn't have much choice. Without Ms. Bailey's say-so, no one was going to speak with me about any illegal activities. Truth be told, nearly everyone Ms. Bailey introduced me to had a fascinating story to tell. One of the most fascinating women I met was Cordella Levy, a close friend of Ms. Bailey. She was 63 years old and had lived in public housing her entire life, the past 30 years in Robert Taylor. She had a Jewish surname, she said, because her grandmother had married a Jewish man. Someone else in her family, however, told me that they were descended from black Hebrew Israelites. Cordella had raised 7 children, all but one of whom had moved out of Robert Taylor. Although she used a walking crutch to get around, Cordella had the fight of a bulldog inside her. She now ran a small candy store inside her apartment. All day long she sat on a stool by the door and waited for children to stop by. Her living room was barren except for the candy, boxes and boxes of lollipops, gum, and candy bars stacked invitingly on a few tables. If you peeked around the corner, you could see into the back bedroom where Cordella had a TV, couches, and so on. But she liked to keep her candy room sparse, she told me, because if customers saw her furniture, they might decide to come back and rob her. "You know," she told me, "I didn't always sell candy."
"You mean you didn't go to school for this?" I joked. "Sweetheart, I never made it past the 4th grade. Black folks weren't really allowed to go to school in the South. What I meant was I used to be somebody different." "Miss Bailey didn't tell you?" I shook my head. She told me you wanted to know how I used to hustle.
I'd love to hear, I said. Cordelia seemed itching to tell her story.
Sweetheart, I've made money around here every which way you can. You know, I started out working for Miss Bailey's mother, Ella Bailey. Ella was a madam, used to have parties in the building. Oh, Lord, she could throw a party.
Miss Bailey's mother was a madam? I laughed. That explains a lot.
Yes, sir, and when she passed, I took over from her. 3 apartments on the 14th floor, Cordella's place, they used to call it. Come in for a drink, play some cards, make a friend, have a nice time.
Make a friend, is that what they used to call it?
Ain't nothing wrong with friendship. And then I started making clothes, and then I sold some food, drove people around for a while to the store. My mother taught me how to sew wedding dresses, so I was doing a lot of...
Wait, I said, slow down. Please, let's get back to helping people make friends. I'm curious why you stopped running the parties. What happened?
I ask because all the people doing that today are men, JT and the pimps. I haven't heard about any women.
That's because they took over. The men ruined everything for us. The first one was JT's mama's cousin, Ms. May's cousin. He just decided to start harassing all the women who were making money. I think it was around 1981. He would beat us up if we didn't pay him money to work out of the building. I had to pay him a few dollars each week to manage my women and throw my parties. He nearly killed my friend because she wouldn't give him money for doing hairstyling in her apartment. He was real awful. On heroin, used to carry around a big gun like he was in the movies, and he was a very violent man.
So what happened? He took over your parties?
Well, all of a sudden, he told me I had to give him 50% of what I was making, and he'd protect me, keep the cops away. But I knew he couldn't keep any cops away. The man was a thug, and wasn't even no good at that. I figured I had been doing it for a while, and so I just gave up and let him have the whole thing. But what I'm saying is that the women ran things around here, before the gangs and the rest of them took over. It was different because we also helped people.
How?
See, people like me had a little power. I could get your apartment fixed or get you out of jail because the cops were my best customers. These folks today, like JT, they can't do that.
What about Miss Bailey?
Yeah, she can, but she's just one person. Imagine if you had about 50 people like her doing their thing. Now, that was a sight. 50 women, all powerful women with no shame. It was a different time. It was a time for women, a place for women.
For several days after I interviewed Cordella, I kept thinking of what she said. It was a time for women, a place for women. Her nostalgia reminded me of how Katrina, Ms. Bailey's assistant, spoke so reverently of women helping each other in the building. I spent the next 3 months focused on meeting the matriarchs of the high-rises. There were plenty to choose from. More than 90% of the 4,000 households in Robert Taylor were headed by a female. Whenever Ms. Bailey introduced me to an elderly dressmaker or a grandmother who offered daycare to working parents, I tried to solicit stories about the past as well as details of her current enterprise. Many of these women had protested for civil rights in the 1960s and campaigned for black political candidates in the 1970s. They took the need to fight for their community very seriously. But during the 1980s and the 1990s, as their plight was worsened by gangs, drugs, and even deeper poverty, they struggled just to keep their families together. By then, the housing authority had grown corrupt and unsupportive, the police were largely unresponsive, and the tribe of strong women had been severely marginalized. While the official statistics said that 96% of Robert Taylor's adult population was unemployed, many tenants did have part-time legitimate jobs, as restaurant workers, cab drivers, cleaning ladies in downtown corporate offices, and nannies to middle-class families.
but nearly all of them tried to hide any legitimate income from the CHA, lest they lose their lease or other welfare benefits. There were also working men living in Robert Taylor, perhaps a few dozen in each building, but they stayed largely out of sight, again, because of the CHA limits on how much money a tenant family could earn. Sometimes a man would leave home for a few weeks just to keep the CHA inspectors off guard. So when I, or someone else they didn't recognize, came into an apartment, the men might head for the back room. They didn't attend many tenant meetings, and for the most part they let the women handle the battle for better living conditions. The absence of men in Robert Taylor had made it that much easier for the gang members and pimps to essentially have the run of the place. As I began compiling statistics on the illicit earnings generated by women throughout Robert Taylor, it became obvious that all their illicit earnings combined hardly constituted a lucrative economy. Selling food or candy out of your apartment might net you about $20 per week. Cordella Levy managed to do better than that, having persuaded a local grocery store to sell her candy wholesale in return for steering her customers to that store for their groceries. Daycare brought in $5 or $10 per day per child, but business wasn't steady. A woman could earn more selling sex, but that was risky in a few ways. One of the favored money-making options, therefore, was to take in a boarder, which could generate $100 a month. There was never any shortage of people who needed a place to stay. But I also discovered something more interesting and probably more important than the money that changed hands in these various transactions. Many households participated in a vast web of exchange in which women borrowed, bartered, and pooled their resources to survive. One woman might offer daycare for a large group of women, another might have a car and contribute by driving folks to buy groceries, and other women might take turns cooking for various families. In some cases, the members of a network maintained a fixed formula of exchange. If you cook my family 5 dinners, I'll take care of your kids for 2 days. Often a network of women would share their apartments as well. Let's say there were 5 women on one floor whose apartments had maintenance problems, which, given the conditions of the buildings, wasn't uncommon. There was little chance that the CHA would respond to all their repair requests, and the women couldn't afford to pay 5 different bribes to Ms. Bailey or the CHA building manager. These women would pool their money to make sure they could pay the necessary bribes so that at least 1 apartment in their network had hot water and at least 2 had working refrigerators and stoves. Perhaps one of them would also pay for pirated cable TV. Everyone would shower in 1 apartment, cook in another apartment, keep their food elsewhere, sit in the 1 air-conditioned room to watch the 1 TV with cable, and so on. To have your own apartment with all utilities functioning was a luxury that few people expected in Robert Taylor. I met most of the neighborhood's male hustlers by hanging out in the local parking lot with C-Note. He let people know that it was safe to speak with me. There were always a lot of men milling around, talking and drinking, who represented the diversity of the neighborhood hustlers. Carpenters who did inexpensive home repairs, freelance preachers, truck drivers who worked off the books for local factories, car thieves, rappers and musicians, cooks and cleaners. All of them made their money under the table. Most of them had once held legitimate jobs that they lost out of either misfortune or misbehavior. Until a few years earlier, they could have gotten a few $100s a month in welfare money. But by 1990, Illinois and many other states eliminated such aid for adult men. The conservative revolution launched by President Ronald Reagan would lead eventually to a complete welfare overhaul, culminating in the 1996 directive by President Bill Clinton that made welfare a temporary program by setting time limits on just about every form of public aid for men, women, and children. For men like the ones in Robert Taylor, the welfare changes only exacerbated their poverty. They all learned to keep track of which restaurants and churches offered free food and which abandoned buildings were available for sleeping. Like the women, the men also had a network. One would cook while another looked for work, while yet another tried to find a place for all of them to sleep. If they heard of a vacant apartment, they'd pool their resources to bribe the CHA building manager, gang leader, tenant leader, or whoever else happened to have the key. These men also passed along information to cops in exchange for get-out-of-jail-free promises, and they could always make a few dollars from CHA janitors, who regularly paid off hustlers to clean the buildings when they felt like taking a day off. C-Note introduced me to Porter Harris, a bone-thin man, 65 years old, who spent much of his time scouring the South Side for recyclable junk. When I met him, he was pushing a shopping cart filled with wire, cans, and metal scrap, trolling the tall grass between the high-rises and the railroad tracks. Years ago, Porter told me, he was the one who dictated where various hustlers in Robert Taylor could work, sell, and trade, much as C-Note did now. But he'd had to leave because of a battle with a gang leader. Booty Caldwell, real name was Carter, he told me in a southern drawl. That was the one who kicked me out of here for good. Porter picked at his few remaining teeth with a blade of grass. He wore a floppy straw hat that made him look as if he'd stepped out of a faded photograph from the old South. There were about 10 of us. I controlled 47th Street to 51st. I had this whole area. You couldn't sell your soul without letting me know about it. Yes, sir.
Sounds like a good living, I said, smiling. You were the king of hustlers?
Lord, king, and chief. Call it what you want. I ran that area. And then one day it was all taken away. By Booty Caldwell. He was part of the El Rucan gang.
By the late 1960s, El Rucan had become the most powerful gang in Chicago. They were widely credited with uniting many independent gangs, making peace treaties and cooperative arrangements that resulted in a few El Rucan super gangs. But a federal indictment in the mid-1980s weakened El Rucan, allowing other gangs, including the Black Kings, to take over the burgeoning crack trade. From Porter, C-Note, and others, I learned that the most profitable hustling jobs for men were in manual labor. You could earn $500 a month fixing cars in a parking lot, or roughly $300 a month cleaning up at the local schools. The worst-paying jobs, meanwhile, often required the longest hours, gathering up scrap metal or aluminum $100 a month, or selling stolen clothes or cigarettes about $75 a month. While just about every hustler I interviewed told me that he was hoping for a legit job and a better life, I rarely saw anyone get out of the hustling racket unless he died or went to jail. One day after I'd spent hours interviewing Porter and some of the other male hustlers, I was summoned to Ms. Bailey's office. I'd been so busy that I hadn't seen her in a while. It was probably a good idea, I thought, to have a catch-up session. I said hello to Katrina on my way in, and she gave me a smile. She was assuming more and more duties and seemed to be acting nearly as a junior officer to Ms. Bailey. Inside, J.T. and Ms. Bailey were laughing together and greeted me heartily.
"Mr. Professor," J.T. said, "my mother says you haven't been by in a month. What, you don't like us anymore? You've found somebody who cooks better?"
"You better not piss off Ms. May," Ms. Bailey said. "You'll never be able to come back in the building again."
"Sorry. All this interviewing has kept me really busy," I said, exasperated. "I just haven't had time to do much of anything else."
"Well, then sit down, baby," Ms. Bailey said. "We won't keep you long. We just wanted to know who you've been meeting. We're curious about what you've learned."
"Hey, you know what? I could actually use the chance to tell you what I've been finding," I said, taking out my notebooks. "I've been meeting so many people, and I can't be sure whether they're telling me the truth about how much they earn. I suppose I want to know whether I'm really understanding what it's like to hustle around here."
"Sure," J.T. said. "We were just talking about that. You used to ask us to find you people. Now you do it yourself. We feel like you don't need us anymore." He started laughing, and so did Miss Bailey.
"Yeah," Miss Bailey said. "Don't leave us behind, Mr. Professor, when you start to be successful. Go ahead, tell me who you've been talking to. If you tell us who you met and what they're doing, maybe we can check for you and see if folks are being straight." For the next 3 hours, I went through my notebooks and told them what I'd learned about dozens of hustlers, male and female. There was Bird, the guy who sold license plates, social security cards, and small appliances out of his van. Doretha, the tax preparer. Candy, one of the only female carpenters in the neighborhood. Prince, the man who could pirate gas and electricity for your apartment. J.T. and Miss Bailey rarely seemed surprised, although every now and then one of them perked up when I mentioned a particularly enterprising hustler or a woman who had recently started taking in boarders. I finally left, riding the bus home to my apartment. I was grateful for having had the opportunity to discuss my findings with two of the neighborhood's most formidable power brokers. As I looked out